Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When comedian Richard Pryor walked on stage, no corner of the human soul or experience was off limits. He crossed lines of color, candor, and forbidden truth-telling like most people cross a street. Last Saturday, Richard Pryor died at 65 after a long battle with multiple sclerosis. But we're not finished hearing from the man who famously grew up in a Peoria brothel, the man who turned the nation's frailties and his own into waves of knowing laughter, the man who put the N-word on stage and tried to pull it off again, the man who many say invented modern stand-up comedy. Up next on Point, the voice and life and impact of comedian Richard Pryor. Joining me now from Washington is Eugene Robinson. He's an associate editor at the Washington Post, where he writes a biweekly column on culture and politics. His column this Tuesday was titled, Richard Pryor, Preacher of Truth. Eugene Robinson, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
How do you begin to think about him now that he's unbelievably gone?
It is unbelievable. Many of us who kind of came of age in the late 60s and through the 70s, really think of Richard Pryor as a cultural signpost, as a giant, and a point of reference. And it's amazing that he's no longer with us. Why was Richard Pryor Richard Pryor? I think in part it was his amazing talent. He was just a really talented comedian who could do everything from impressions to telling dirty jokes to the whole range of anything a comedian does. Mm. And second, I think it was the moment. I mean, it was a moment in Black America, a moment of an explosion of a different kind of race consciousness, the ability to say things that couldn't have been said before, especially in front of white audiences, and Richard Pryor, to our astonishment, was out there saying them.
We want to get a good big earful of Richard Pryor as we look back on his life and look at his work. Here from 1980, listen with me, Eugene Robinson, is Pryor. It was in 80 that he suffered third-degree burns over most of his body. He caught fire while freebasing cocaine, reportedly, and talked a lot about it.
Now, here's how I really burn up. Now, everybody know, my friends really know how it happened, okay? Usually before I go to bed, I have a little milk and cookies. No, I do. And one night, I had that low-fat milk and that pasteurized, and I dipped my cookie in, and the shit blew up. And it scared the shit out of me. Not the blowing up, but it caught on fire. And you know what? It is weird to catch on fire. I don't know if anybody else in here, you ever been just burned up? It is weird because you go, hey, I'm not in the fireplace. I am f***ing burning up. Catching on fire is inspiring. They should use it for the Olympics. Because I did the 100-yard dash in about 4:06 in the underbrush. And you know something I noticed? When you run down the street on fire, people will move out of your way. Right? They don't f*** around. They get the f*** out your way. Except for one old drunk, right? He was going, hey, buddy, can we get a light? Come on, pal, just slow up, okay? Just a little off the sleeve, what is it? And I got to the hospital. You can really tell when you f***ed up, when the doctor goes, ah! Holy shit. Why don't we just get some coleslaw and serve this up? What do you say?
Richard Pryor, looking back on what was really a dreadful moment in his life when he was literally running down the street on fire, reportedly after freebasing cocaine. Eugene Robinson is with us from the Washington Post. And Eugene, I'm sure you and I sound as though we're of the age we can both look back and remember when these kind of routines were in the air, and it just brought people to their knees in laughter in a way that I personally do not recall having been brought there before that time. You and I also looked at it from opposite sides of a race line, and he had a lot to do with race. I mean, here I was a white guy listening and just in tears of laughter. You as a black man, were we hearing the same thing, or were there two different messages, you know, laugh lines going on?
Well, we actually were hearing the same thing. I mean, that's part of Richard Pryor's genius. You know, for black people growing up in coming of age in that era and hearing Richard Pryor, it was amazing that he was saying what he said in front of white audiences and being funny in that way. And of course, it's, you know, much is made of his use of the of what is now called the N-word.
And we'll talk about that. But are you saying that if white people had just been in black clubs, they would have heard this kind and quality of humor all the time? I mean, surely it wasn't just... He did cross the line, but it wasn't just that he brought white folks into the conversation, was it?
No. It was that he was brilliant. I mean, I don't think anybody had made, you know, trying to commit suicide after freebasing for 3 days.
This is new material.
Such a funny routine before. Mm-hmm. but black audiences had heard ribald, risque, racially oriented humor in black clubs before from the likes of Red Fox or Moms Mabley or other comedians who, when they got a chance to appear on Ed Sullivan, toned down their act and became less threatening. But I remember, you know, when I was a kid, the adults would kind of keep the Moms Mabley and Red Fox album someplace where the kids wouldn't get them. And, and of course, we would get them and listen to them, and they were very funny. But that sort of, you know, risque quality has been around for a while.
Let's listen to an interview from 1974. Richard Pryor talking here with Rolling Stone about his honesty on stage.
I think that people should say what they feel. I mean, you know, I don't give a f- if... racism or whatever ism it is. I mean, whatever, man. Just to be yourself. That's such a nice thing. I like to be accepted, you know? But usually, in order to be accepted by white people, you have to compromise so much from your hello.
Compromise from the hello, and Richard Pryor did not do it. Eugene Robinson is with us. Tom Ma is calling from East Lansing, Michigan. Tom Ma, welcome. Thanks for calling. What do you know?
Hi, this is Tama.
Tama, and, I'm sorry. It's good to have you.
Okay, thank you. I'm just calling to say that when I was in 7th, 8th grade in the early 70s, that we would sneak in the basement and listen to Richard Pryor, and all of my cousins and brothers would memorize the lines word for word and perform them, and we would just laugh, and I learned so much about relationships and sex, and it was really my first, you know, introduction to those kinds of things, and I recognize all the characters, the winos, the drug addicts, because, you know, not that I came from a bad neighborhood, but there was an after-hours joint in our neighborhood, and I recognized lots of what he talked about in that Southern culture, and the storytelling was just very familiar to me.
Did you feel lifted up or known or offended?
Not at all offended. It was funny. It was, as I said, it was recognizable. Mm-hmm. You know, the words were naughty, and I knew that was something there, but... that I wasn't supposed to listen to, but I just got great joy out of listening to him.
And Tama, do you recall, as you listened with your brothers and sisters, Eugene Robinson was saying, you know, white folks were listening at the same time, maybe not in that, you know, in your room there, but do you recall thinking, gosh, this isn't just us listening, this is everybody. It's amazing that...
I never thought about whites listening. It was, you know, our world, and like I said, my cousins and my friends and my brothers, so it was just kind of our little thing, and we thought it was just all ours.
Who do you see carrying it on now, Tama?
I would probably say Chris Rock comes closest. His humor is smart and it's political. And Richard Pryor was extremely political. And if you look at his old television show that only lasted one summer, It's so obvious that he just was the best social commentary, gave the best social commentary out there. And we have tapes of those old shows, and they are just great.
It was pretty wild and pretty true. It didn't last long, but it was something while it did. Tama, thank you very much for your call from East Lansing in Michigan there. Eugene Robinson, I want to welcome into our conversation from Los Angeles one of the comics who was influenced by Richard Pryor. Wanda Sykes is with us, two-time Emmy Award-winning writer, comedian. She stars in Wanda Does It on Comedy Central every week. She tries various non-showbiz jobs. In 2003, she starred on the Fox sitcom Wanda at Large. Wanda Sykes, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And a lot of us know you, of course, as well from HBO's Curb Your Enthusiasm, your great presence there. Your thoughts on what Richard Pryor gave to comedians like you with the path that he carved?
Oh, well, Richard Pryor was, he was the most influential comedian of our time and probably ever. I mean, he changed the face of comedy. Comedy became something different after Richard Pryor. You know, he set a different standard. He opened, changed our thought process and our approach, because he just opened it up where it's like, I think before Richard, like, comics were doing an impersonation of what a comedian does. It's like, okay, you know, I get on stage and I wear a suit and I be funny and I tell jokes. But Richard personalized it. You know, it became this real thing. And you talk about, you know, even your faults. You know, you can get up there and be, hey, I'm a screwed up person, but, you know, just be real honest with it. And he just took it to a whole nother realm.
Wanda Sykes, when you first saw him do that, when you first heard him do that, did it, as a comedian or budding comedian then, did it immediately look attractive to you, or did it look dangerous, like, oh my God, I don't know if I can put all my vulnerabilities, my personal quirks out there the way Richard Pryor does?
Oh, I advise any young comic who, you better see Richard Pryor first.
And or don't bother.
Stand up. Or if you go do stand up and you think you're good, then look at Richard Pryor and you will realize how awful you are. You know, it really does. I mean, of course I loved Richard Pryor before I even started doing stand up. And then after I started doing stand up, I was like, let me, you know, look at Richard Pryor live again. And I watched that and I just realized how far I was from being, you know, even a good comic, you know. I mean, I don't think anyone even comes close to him, but, man, I mean, when you just watch him, you just realize how inferior everyone else is.
Wanda Sykes, it's wonderful to have a chance to talk with you today. Thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, I thank you.
Wanda Sykes joined us from Los Angeles, two-time Emmy Award winner, stars in Wanda Does It on Comedy Central every week. Let's hear a little tape from Richard Pryor talking about that 1979 trip that he took to Africa.
So I went to the motherland. It was so beautiful. Just seeing black people in charge of everything. I'm talking about from the wino to the president. It was black. Blue black. Original black. The kind of black where you go, black. And landing at the airport in Nairobi, man, just fill your heart up. You see, you look at all the black people. And you realize that people are the same all over the world. Because people in Africa f*** over your luggage just like people in New York.
Richard Pryor on What's Universal and What's Not from a 1979 trip to Africa. I want to welcome into our conversation from Santa Cruz, California, Tricia Rose. She's professor of American Studies at the University of California at Santa Cruz, specializes in 20th century African-American culture and politics, social thought, and popular culture. Tricia Rose, I guess Richard Pryor has to stand right in the middle of all that.
Absolutely. He's amazing. He's been so important for really dealing with the consciousness that the transition from a pre-civil rights to a post-civil rights America has been about. And he really is quite on the line of making a whole generation come to deal with that.
When you look at his influence, we talked with Eugene Robinson about this, across the race line, was he, equally liberating for blacks and whites? Are you saying he sort of let the conversation become more real and whole because he addressed it so frankly, so candidly?
Well, I wouldn't say equally liberating. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that we've chosen as a nation to be quite amnesic about is that segregation was both a physical process and a cultural process. Mm-hmm. So it produced a cultural segregation that was not quite even, obviously.
Right.
And it meant that the reception of black culture was always shaped by larger perceptions of black people who were always on the short end of that racial stick. So when whites and blacks listened to Pryor, they were not hearing, they were hearing the same words technically, but they really were not hearing the same thing, because one of the critical facets of segregation is to produce a conception of blackness that you have to constantly work against if you want to see a whole, complex, human African-American. And so some whites certainly listened and saw a rich complexity that they were hoping to see, but I would argue that many were able to take some of what Pryor was doing and fit it into their already existing conceptions. I mean, that's really the double-edged sword of a black, quote-unquote, crossover performance of any kind.
Robert's calling from Nashville right now. Robert, you're on the air.
Good day, Tom, and good day to Tricia and Eugene as well. Thank you so very much, Tom, for having this particular program. I grew up in Cleveland, Ohio. I was born in 1963.
Yeah.
And so for me, growing up and listening to Richard Pryor, I felt, one, emotionally lifted with what was going on around me, and I always felt that I was being educated to the underworkings of the world around me as it pertained to racism, as it pertained to sex, religion, and the black church. I lived on the all-black side of town, and so, you know, I heard people talking about racism, but I didn't really understand what was going on, only through the words of my parents and my grandparents. Mm. But Richard was, to me, world-traveled, and so he gave a broader perspective. And I also felt that I visited Africa vicariously through Richard's experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I should say, too, that I performed stand-up comedy here in Nashville and a few other places. And,
good for you.
Thank you very much. Although I've loved and respected and admired and looked up to Richard, I never felt that I needed to go on stage and become him, but somehow the parallels in which our lives, I guess, share, try to bring my own perspective of that through the stage, but certainly through his example, try very, very hard to be myself, you know, that honestly, just really being myself and bringing that common man, that common black man to the stage.
We love the testimony, and we're delighted to have it, Robert. Thanks very much for calling in with that from Nashville. Eugene Robinson, Robert describes it interestingly as emotionally lifted by Richard Pryor, even as Pryor kind of brought the news. And there was something of grace about Pryor. Not mean, even when he talked dirty, it wasn't exactly nasty in a mean or vicious sense. There was a kind of grace in this man. Where do you see the root of that?
I think you're absolutely right. There was always grace in him. There was no bitterness in him. I think that must be a reflection of the person, and again, it's a reflection of the talent. I think he found a way of communicating, very shrewdly found a way of communicating that managed to say harsh things without sounding harsh, that managed to talk about racism without without the bitterness that others might naturally express talking about racism. Mm. And as a result, I think he communicated very effectively.
And yet he would use any word. He'd get as raunchy as you want to be to get it across. Tricia Rose, Stanley Crouch, essayist, black conservative, has written about Richard Pryor since his passing. And he's very tough on him. He says, yes, this was a genius. But then he looks around at all the vulgarity in culture today, and he writes this. He says, in the dung piles of pimp and gangster rap, we hear from slime meisters, Stanley Crouch's words, like Snoop Dogg and 50 Cent, the worst of Pryor's influence has been turned into an aspect of the new minstrelsy. He says, on balance, it wasn't worth it. It was too vulgar. It took us down more than it lifted us up. How do you see that, Tricia?
Well, first of all, I think that we have to take quite seriously concerns about what I said earlier about the context of reception, and this is actually an important context to see this in. If the richness and complexity of black people were genuinely able to be witnessed by dominant American society, mm-hmm. then there wouldn't be such an obsession, really, with this idea of the pimp, the gangster, the underworld of black life.
Whose obsession? White obsession?
Definitely. I mean, the vast majority of gangster rap is purchased by young white males.
Yep.
And you know, the sort of less commercially successful hip-hop, the marginal hip-hop, you know, is not really what, is not that kind of agenda. And again, I think that's part of what Richard Pryor was also able to tap into, was this sort of, you know, love-hate dynamic around a fantasy and exoticization. The Harlem Renaissance had very similar constructions around it.
Mm-hmm.
So there is something to be said of that. Now, that said, I think that he is, Crouch, is too hard on Pryor. And more importantly, it's about how you use what you use. Pryor was a genius in both the way he used what he used and the fact that the richness of black life was never overshadowed by his use of certain words, the N-word and other words and other characters. He was an incredible participant observer of black life and a keen storyteller. This is not the case of everyone who chooses to be vulgar in the public realm. Do you see my point?
Absolutely.
And I think that to say that because in the hands of either amateurs, hacks, or people who are more interested simply in money, that means then we should have just kept a lid on it, doesn't get at the fundamental problem. We would then just have a veneer of civility that would enable the very same kind of racialized ideas that are at the heart of the problem.
So there's a chance, then, you say, to sort of paste a minstrel face on this and have it be degrading, but in Richard Pryor's hands, it wasn't. I wonder if this goes back to what Eugene Robinson was saying about the, there was a kind of fundamental humanity, even very simple but deep kindness, that you always heard, even when things were rough and rolling with Richard Pryor here.
Absolutely. And even more importantly, you know, we had minstrelsy for 100 of years without vulgarity, right, being performed as its primary narrative. So one needn't have vulgarity to have minstrelsy. You can have bourgeois minstrelsy. You know, you can have perfectly legitimate Christian minstrelsy. You know, you don't have to have vulgarity. So I think there's a kind of false a link here between those two that is not automatic. And, you know, and I think that it's very important that, you know, we really recognize what I think made his art so important. And that was that there was there's a tragic comic character of black life, cross-class.
Mm-hmm.
And that tragic comic intersection, the idea that you have to laugh and cry all at once just to manage the absurdity of being black in a country that is both democracy-ridden, freedom narrative-oriented, and deeply racist. You know, it's so
all
much contradiction
right.
that to manage that, you have to have an incredible sense of humor and a deep attachment to the pain that causes.
Yeah.
And I think that in order to really understand the power of Richard Pryor, it's to be able to see how much he captured that and showed the richness and complexity how black people survived that experience. Now, anyone who's intelligent is going to see that and be moved by it, cross race. But
absolutely.
He was also really tapping into what it means to survive that environment from a black subjectivity.
I love the way you put that. As a white observer, I could always, you could see that horrible dilemma that he and sort of the race were caught in. He painted it so clearly, but he also then reached across with a kind of this humanity that let me, white guy, say, yes, I hear you saying that. It's a conduit that lets that emotion, that complexity, that problem come straight through to me, and maybe other whites as well. Steve is calling from Denver, Iowa. Steve, you're on the air.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Great to have you, Steve. What do you think?
I was reflecting on the way home listening to your program, and I was amazed by remembering my first listening to Bill Cosby on a record.
Way back.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And not realizing till probably halfway through the record and looking at the cover that this was a black man.
Is that good or bad or just different, Steve?
I think that because they were in different time frames that Bill Cosby had to sound more, I guess, Caucasian, for lack of a better word, than where I felt like when I listened to Richard Pryor, I remember the first time I listened to one of his records, and I felt like a sneaky little boy who got into a R-rated movie, you know, without mom letting you know.
And you had.
and I had such an insight and such a wonderful look at what goes on with the plight of the black man and how, you know, how racism and how discrimination is used, you know, and treated towards them. And I felt really good that he was letting me know what was going on.
And the way he would just stare at the audience as if to say, do you see, do you see, do you see what I'm talking about? Steve, thanks for your call. Eugene Robinson, what about this evolution, migration from Nipsey Russell and Bill Cosby and Flip Wilson to the Richard Pryor track? How would you define that evolution?
I think, to me at least, I think Wanda Sykes was pretty much on point. Richard Pryor went deeper inside himself, deeper, reached a more inner point of experience, talked about his failings and his weaknesses along with his triumphs, and did it with such skill that I just think he reached a different level. You know, when I was growing up, there was nobody had any doubt in my house whether or not Bill Cosby was black. Mm. And when he talked about his experiences growing up, we laughed. It was very funny. You could see the black experience reflected in what he talked about as well. With Richard Pryor, it was different though, and in a sense, it reflected the time. I mean, the times were changing, and attitudes about race and racism and analysis of racism was changing, and again, the times changed as much as the comics did.
And here's a man who helped change them. Clint's calling from Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Clint. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. How are you doing today?
We're good. What do you think, Clint?
Well, I tell you what, I agree with everything that everybody has said, particularly the first young lady that spoke about how Richard Pryor affected her. I did the exact same thing. And even today, I'm 43 years old, and
yeah.
I started listening to Pryor at 13.
Yeah.
I go to church, and he used to do stand-up routines about ministers at church.
All the time.
Even now, when I go to church, to a traditional black church, I'm laughing. And people are looking at me like, what is wrong with that guy? Because I'm thinking of all the church scenes that Richard Pryor and ministers he imitated over the years, and it comes right out at you.
Right, he's taken the stuffing out of them, and you've seen it, and now it's hard to see it any other way.
That's exactly right. It's and every time I go to church, I'm sitting there, and it's a serious moment in the church,
right.
and the minister goes into his routine, I start laughing.
And pretty soon, you're chuckling, and the eyeballs are turning your way. Clint, thanks for that glimpse, and we can sure understand it exactly. Tricia Rose,
yeah.
he really did sort of take on some of these forms and have an awful lot of fun with what was behind it.
Yeah, you know, I think because he was broke the sort of the race barrier around certain words and certain kinds of excess, that we miss, that we overemphasize that, his drug use and
mm-hmm.
et cetera, et cetera. Most, entertainers have complex personal lives because
yep.
they live in such an emotionally intense place. But he was an amazing storyteller and participant observer of the wide range, as I said earlier, of black life, ministers, everyday people, you know, certainly sometimes street hustlers. But it was a wide range, and I think we really need to remember that. The other thing I wanted to comment on very quickly was that, you know, he was pretty... A lot of whites were offended by him. I mean, you, Tom, and others probably enjoyed him and got some insight. But I just recently read an article about him in which Earl of Fari Hutchinson
yes.
said that, you know, many whites would sort of begin to trickle out, leave, and then a stampede of whites leaving his stand-up routines because they felt squirmy. You know, they felt targeted, and that he was really just constantly hitting at them about racism, and they didn't know what to do with that and left. But he also
said,
yeah, well, you know, and then he would just continue. He didn't stop.
Yeah.
Because of that. And then in some cases, he said, Ofari Hutchinson pointed out
yeah.
that, you know, look, people came back, right? That there was, he was doing something that they needed to hear, even though it also produced a lot of pain and a lot of discomfort. So this wasn't just a happy, you know, experience all the time.
Amen. Amen. And now he's gone, and we wish he wasn't. Let's get just a little bit more of Richard Pryor in our ear. Here's Richard Pryor on getting older.
When I was like 20, I used to could dance a little bit. I never was a great dancer or nothing. You know what I mean? Never could really get down. But I dance like this. See, I go out and dance. Don't be moving too much with me. I be... get a few moves in my show. Some shit like that, yeah. But man, I was at a party. I saw Michael Jackson. This motherfucker spin 20 minutes. Then walk forward, backwards. Say, wait a minute, motherfucker. Don't be dancing out here with me. Not doing that shit. I'm up here doing this shit. You talking about, hey, you.
Richard Pryor bleeps and all on getting older. Eugene Robinson, and now he's gone. As you look around the landscape of black humor today, black humorists, comedians, or even leave the race piece out of it, who's got his torch?
Well, I don't see anyone who's another Richard Pryor. I'm fascinated with Dave Chappelle, mm-hmm. Not long ago had a kind of informal focus group, unplanned focus group in my living room, and my mother-in-law, who's right. in her nearly 80, and my son, who's 15, and I were sitting there, and we watched an episode of the Dave Chappelle show, and we were all falling on the floor at the end of it. Mm. So he has. He has an interesting twist to his comedy. I don't know who, though, has the staying power and the creativity of Richard Pryor right now.
Tricia Rose, what do you think about the torch? Dave Chappelle, very funny, but it's softer. He doesn't quite have that high-pitched edge that comes in. How do you see it?
Well, I think that we're all products of our time, and so there will not be, as Eugene said, another Richard Pryor. I think Chappelle has certain components of his talent, and I think Chris Rock has certain components of it, but I don't think there's the all-around perception. And I think the other critical thing I'd want to call on the next generation to think about is the way in which he really tapped into black humanity, not just rage, not just performance of blackness in the public realm, but kind of private, intimate blackness that he was able to reveal. And that the next true so-called Richard Pryor will have to master that.
He did it, and it let the genius flow. Quincy Jones, calling the Truth Machine, we say amen to that, and wish him happy trails right on up. Tricia Rose at the University of California, Santa Cruz, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Eugene Robinson at the Washington Post, love your column, loved having you with us, Eugene. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. It was a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.